Good morning. First order of business is to ask you to turn off your cell phones and don't even put them on vibrate, but turn them off because they interfere with the sound system, and we're taping this so we can put it on our website. Thank you. I'm David Smock from the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I want to welcome you all this morning. We're particularly pleased to be able to co-sponsor this event with the organizations that have been our partners on various other topics, including SICE and the Woodrow Wilson Center and CSIS and the Council on Foreign Relations. We've been waiting for a year now for the Niger Delta consultation and peace plan that the president has been promising, but nothing yet. The bunkering, the corruption, the underdevelopment, the operations, the militias continue. Oil production is periodically sharply cut, with production averaging 20% below capacity. For a variety of reasons, most of the natural gas produced is flared rather than captured and liquefied for export. The 13% allocation of oil income to the states and the Delta remains a point of contention and discontent. But even more disturbing to the people of the Delta is how little the oil money finds its way to local development projects. While there is now transparency in terms of how much the oil companies pay to the government and how much of that money goes to each state, there is very little transparency regarding how these funds are allocated and spent by the states. The oil companies continue to experiment with new forms of development assistance to the communities in the Delta, making corrections and learning from past mistakes, but still not fully comfortable with their approaches. The most egregious environmental damage and community exploitation by the oil companies is now in the past, but companies continue to face community discontent over damage from gas flaring, disputes over contract interpretations, rent payments, resentment over limited employment opportunities, etc. The price of oil internationally approached $120 earlier this week, in part because of disruptions in production in Nigeria. Exxon sharply curtailed production because of a strike. Royal Dutch Shell suffered a pipeline attack by Niger Delta rebels, cutting 350,000 barrels a day. Shell suffered a bombing raid that cut production by 169,000 barrels a day. Various organizations and planning mechanisms have been established to coordinate effort and channel development funds, including the Niger Delta Development Commission and the Niger Delta Regional Development Master Plan, but these have had only limited positive impact. Overall, the situation in the Niger Delta is a national disgrace, and unless dramatic action is taken, the situation could become worse, even much worse. You are all aware of the basic facts as I've described them. The purpose of today's discussion is not to reiterate the disasters, rather we want to point to the future. We want to give particular attention to what contribution the international community can make to bring peace, stability, and greater prosperity to the people of the Delta. What can the oil companies do? What can the UN and other international organizations do? What can the U.S. and European partners do in collaboration with the Nigerian government and organizations in the Delta? Nigeria has been inclined to view the Delta as a Nigerian problem, needing a Nigerian solution, but there may be more openness now to international collaboration. What lessons can be learned from conflict zones elsewhere in the world that might be instructive in the Niger Delta? I'm going to turn over now to my co-moderator, Steve Morrison of CSIS, who will be introducing the speakers.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming. And David, thank you for welcoming us here as partner again with USIP and in putting this together. I think at the base of our motivation for trying to pull this together is a sense that maybe something's changing with respect to the Niger Delta. Maybe we're going to come away at the end of today with a better sense of whether that's a true statement or not. There's just a terrible amount of encrusted cynicism around the Niger Delta over the years, and we've had many meetings that all seem to sort of gravitate towards a similar set of rather dismal conclusions that all left us somewhat depressed, and then we went away and 6 months later came back to kind of review again what was happening with respect to violence on the ground, bunkering, weapons trafficking, corruption, and the like, and to ask ourselves to puzzle over the question of what does this add up to? Does it have some destabilizing consequence within Nigeria or within the surrounding region? And who cares about it? Who cares about it within Nigeria? Who cares about it beyond Nigeria? And what might be done? And I have to admit that this is one of those really hard, complex, chronic, nasty, conflicted settings where we haven't done very well in the last decade or more in trying to puzzle a way forward. And so today we're back at this and we're asking ourselves, first of all, are things changing? Internally, among the activists within the communities in the Delta, are they thinking and looking forward in a new and different way as to the kind of agenda they would like to pursue? Are they getting any attention or any support from within Nigeria itself? Since we've seen for many years that there's been very weak voice and very weak interest beyond the Delta in taking this issue up as a national priority. And secondly, are some of these initiatives or thinking, new forms of thinking, do they offer a space for an external partner, for an external presence or form of support? Because it's been very, very clear that certainly at a political level within Nigeria, there's been a big blockage on internationalizing or extending a hand or welcoming in external parties to this, which has, when you combine that sort of factor with the disinterest internally within the political class in picking this issue up, you've got a formula for a sort of long-range stasis, a long-range sort of rejection of pursuing more forward-looking options. So I think all of our speakers here today, Peter Lewis, Judy Asuni, and Darren Q, are people who have been thinking in a very positive way and a very realistic but analytic way at trying to imagine whether or not circumstances are changing, in what ways, both internally within Nigeria and within the Delta, and externally, and what might a way forward look like? What would that strategy look like? And so we've asked the three of them to come and reflect. And we're going to run through three quick presentations, and then we're going to come back to you and ask you for comments and questions in the time that remains. We'll run up until noon. We'll be finished at noon. Some of our speakers may be able to stick around a little bit beyond that to carry forward the conversation. Peter is going to be our first speaker. All of the three speakers are known to all of you. I won't give extensive introductions. Peter, of course, is the Associate Professor and Director of African Studies right here in Washington at Johns Hopkins. He is a renowned figure on African political economy and political economy on Indonesia as well. He served in very many settings over the course of his distinguished career, and he's one of the best and brightest of American political scientists who made a commitment going back two decades ago to Nigeria and has stuck to that for a very long period of time. So we're very fortunate to have him, and very fortunate to have him right here in Washington with us. So, Peter, would you like to kick off?
Sure. Thanks.
I think I'll speak from the podium so everybody can see as I look at the configuration of the room. Thanks. By way of launching this discussion about the way forward in the Niger Delta, I think it is helpful to summarize where we seem to be now and how we got here and what the fundamental issues are and how we might begin to move forward. And then the other members of the panel, Dr. Judith Asuni and Professor Darren Q, will talk about other aspects of the current situation and what kinds of options we have as we think about strategies for crafting a way out of the current impasse. What are the central trends and issues in the Niger Delta that we see today? They've been alluded to and summarized. Shut-ins of oil production are fluctuating between 400 and 900,000 barrels per day, which is between 20-25% of potential Nigerian production. So a very large percentage, as well as a very large volume of oil, is being taken out of Nigeria's production stream and out of global markets. Abductions for ransom have become chronic, escalating particularly last year, and spilling over from one category, which is essentially oil workers and people associated with the oil industry, to kidnapping of children and other civilians, if you will. So there's been an expansion of that. There's been a fragmentation of both violence and criminality in the Niger Delta. There's currently a military stalemate between a diverse set of militants throughout the Delta, particularly the main three states, Delta, Bayelsa, and River states, and a Nigerian military force, which is frequently outgunned and outmaneuvered. This leads to chronic insecurity in many rural areas, and it has encroached in the last year and a half or 2 years well into Port Harcourt, and so there is chronic insecurity in the region. Against this backdrop of insecurity, conflict, and violence and criminality, there's been no progress in development or in issues of revenue allocation, which have been politically salient. There's no palpable forward movement on the ground in terms of any development, roads, infrastructure, social services, employment, economic growth schemes, or what have you. There is a striking absence of democracy in the core Delta states. There have simply been no credible elections there since 1999 and the transition to democracy. All of these elections have been witnessed by domestic and international observers who have seen single-digit participation rates on the ground and then reported rates of participation up to 123%. Very civic-minded voters who came in the last 15 minutes of polling in Bayelsa in 2003 with 90% margins for the winning party. And the environmental crisis that has been chronic in the Delta is unabated with flaring and oil spills, despite efforts to stem them, really undiminished. This creates a fundamental challenge domestically to Nigeria's security and its economic stability, and it also obviously creates questions and challenges for global markets. So we want to think about how we got here, and we want to think about the way forward. It's useful to spend maybe 3 minutes on a thumbnail sketch of how this conflict has evolved in the contemporary era. I'm not going back to the 19th century. I'm not going back to the 1950s. You can start at many points in these conflicts, but I want to begin in 1990 with the launching of the MOSOP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, and the Ogoni movement in Rivers State, which in the early 1990s really launched and tabled and articulated a set of grievances which remain with us today. Their grievances and their demands were for resource control, a greater say over the use and the proceeds of the resources under their ground, a claim for equal development, although their region was generating a lot of oil wealth. It was among the poorest in the country, and they had not borne the fruits of development. Environmental remediation in these fishing and farming communities, these riverine communities, acid rain, oil spills, soil degradation, and so forth, were diminishing the possibilities for livelihoods. And very quickly, the issue of human rights began to become salient as well, as peaceful protests and a sort of petition politics were met with arrests, repression, and violence from the then military regime. The Ogoni movement really met its, what should we say, nadir in 1995 with the what have become known as the judicial killings of the Ogoni Nine, Ken Saro-Wiwa and his compatriots. And then things shifted very decisively west toward a nexus of Ijaw, Ichikiri, Urhobo, Ilaje communities in Bayelsa, Delta State, and some other states in the region, Edo, and so forth. But the Ijaw, being the largest group in the region, have become the centerpiece for mobilization and political action. It began over boundaries and resources, and there were inter-ethnic dimensions to it, but quickly shifted to demands, really mainly on the part of the Ijaw group, for accountability and voice for the region. The Kayama Declaration carried forward these demands, and the costs and tensions of protest in the region were dramatically in sharp relief with the Oti massacre of November 1999, in which it's estimated several dozen to several hundred people were killed by the Nigerian military. Since then, despite a brief lull after democratization in 1999, there has been, unfortunately, a sharp escalation and militarization of the conflict in the Niger Delta. This has been carried forward by the creation and financing of political militias under the aegis of various candidates and political party operatives, the proliferation of oil bunkering or smuggling, and the incursion of small arms and light weapons through a series of regional and international markets into the region. This has led the nexus of oil bunkering and small arms and light weapons has led to a dramatic proliferation and much heavier arming of the militias. Mujahid Dekubo Asari and his Niger Delta People's Volunteer Force, Ateke Tom, around 2002-2003. And then those movements have really morphed into the MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, which really arose in 2006. What we see since then is fragmentation of these militias. The MEND is at best a network and not a coherent organization. It does not have a political wing. It does not have a clear organizational presence from which to negotiate with the government or the oil companies. But in fact, we see the fragmentation of militias, the incursion and spread of economic motives in many of the activities of the militants, whereby hostage taking and bunkering really become subsistence strategies rather than part of a broader political strategy. The overlay of criminalization and criminal activities on top of or intermingled with the legitimate political goals and fundamental grievances of the region, and the very problematic problem of political sponsorship of the militias, which is keeping many of them going. Sponsorship by state governments, by party operatives, some people have alleged by even elements in the military. So this is where we are, and more or less how we got there. What are the outlets for resolution? Let me start off the discussion, which will proceed in much more thoughtful directions and much greater detail with my colleagues, by just talking about what I think we need to keep our eye on in terms of the general framework, the general priorities, and the general issues before us. First of all, we need a political process in the Niger Delta, which has really been absent prior to the present moment, or until now. We need to have all the leading parties to the conflict at the table. This would include, at a minimum, the government, the communities, representatives of the militants, and very likely representatives or at least observers from the leading companies who are doing business in the Niger Delta. there needs to be a framework for discussion. The grievances and the issues need to be articulated and laid out so we have an agenda for moving forward. And we really have been looking for, and the absence has been quite stark, that we do not have a trusted or central intermediary or representative who can motivate a dialogue. There is no eminent persons group. There is no designated mediator. There is no framework for moving this process forward, at least so far not in any effective way. Part of a comprehensive solution to the problems and the conflict in the Delta would include not only a political process, but also jump-starting development, some type of fast-track process which could begin to produce evidence of road construction, employment, clinics, schools, power lines, and so forth in the region. This might best be accomplished through a set of decentralized or localized community trusts rather than some central, federally sponsored entity such as the Niger Delta Development Commission. And an effort really in promoting development, an effort to move resources not so much through federal or state governments, but through community organizations which have some degree of accountability. And rather than trusting the rather opaque mechanisms and channels of governmental allocations. There is a fundamental contradiction that I want to just highlight in terms of a strategy for moving forward on the Delta, and that is there's a contradiction in terms of federalism here. On the one hand, what is called for in a resolution of the conflict in the Delta is what many Nigerians are calling true federalism. In other words, there needs to be more localized resource control, and there certainly needs to be more democracy on the ground in the states of the Niger Delta. So that is making federalism real, giving the provisions in the Constitution and the various revenue allocation formulas and the budget systems, giving them some substance so that there's not this overarching or domination by the center. But at the same time, the federal government needs to step in a more assertive way in the Niger Delta. There's got to be some kind of strategy for dealing with rogue governors who are establishing their own fiefdoms through violence and fraud and corruption, and who are major catalysts in the dilemmas that Steve and David have outlined at the beginning of our session. There has to be an effort on the part of the federal government to articulate and put into place some kind of responsible security role. We all agree that simply unleashing the military would be disastrous and counterproductive, but equally there's got to be some kind of security presence in the Niger Delta rather than simply holding back in the face of increasingly heavily armed militants. And the Nigerian government has to create some kind of framework for moving forward governance and development in the region. Obviously, the security issue, the security challenges require some kind of provisional ceasefire arrangement. There have been rough ceasefire arrangements in place in the last few months. My colleagues will talk more about this, and a way of reining in the political militias, as we've talked about. And then finally, I want to come to my concluding point, which is what's the role for the international community? The international community has been both passive but also rather confused, as Steve Morrison talked about what to do. Thus far, the Nigerian government, both the Obasanjo administration and the Aradu administration, have politely but firmly said, this is a sovereign internal matter. We will take care of it. Thank you very much. Your help is not needed. I don't think we can settle for that anymore. And I think that the international presence, spearheaded by the U.S. and Britain, could provide a variety of factors in terms of mediation, in terms of guarantees for the various parties, and possibly in terms of resources. in terms of moving this conflict forward. And what this is going to call for, I think, is more assertive engagement with the government of Nigeria. This has nothing to do with a military role, which is and should be off the table. There should be no discussion or consideration of a U.S. military role. None is currently contemplated, and none should be discussed. But on the political and economic side, there could be a much more assertive and forceful engagement with Nigerian governments. Nigeria certainly is a sovereign state, but it is also a highly troubled and vulnerable state. And there are many stakeholders outside of Nigeria who are invested in what happens in Nigeria. And so making compelling arguments to the Nigerian government, exerting quiet diplomatic and political pressure on Nigerian leaders to admit some constructive role for international mediators and international interlocutors, and providing some kind of creative ideas for various parties to the conflict, which could also include the militants, the state governments, and the central government, I think are imperative roles for international actors to play, and a very important thing for us to contemplate as we continue our discussions today. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Our next speaker is Dr. Judith Burden Asuni, who's known to many of you. She's had different roles that are quite exceptional, different roles with respect to the Niger Delta that really set her apart. She's the founder and executive director of Academic Associates Peaceworks, AAPW, and it's there that she really pioneered many of the initiatives on the ground in the Delta in recent years, including the 2004 accord between Asare and Ateki. She built up a series of networks, a series of programs and facilities concentrated on the militias, concentrated on attempting to decommission and move militia members into a less militarized place in life. This put her into, I think, a position of high risk at different points. Last year, she spent a number of weeks in prison, which, of course, got all of us quite concerned, and we were very pleased to see that that ended in a reasonably good point, and has brought Judy here to spend some time in Washington helping us think these next steps forward. She brings, as I said, exceptional deep knowledge of the militias themselves, of the political realities of this mix between grievance and greed and criminality, and of the way in which the political leadership within the regions and at the federal level complicate or potentially play into these forms of organized violence that exist there. She's very courageous. She is very exceptional, and we're delighted to have you here today, Judy.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you very much. It's nice to see a number of friendly faces in the audience this morning. In March 2006, I gave a presentation at the University of Port Harcourt called Conflict and Instability in the Niger Delta. This was based on a number of ideas that came out of the Yanagawa meeting that we had, which was actually hosted by the current vice president. And at the back, there's a Yanagawa Accord consensus. This meeting had included everybody that you can imagine, political figures, top military people, top executives of the oil companies, members of the diplomatic community, and youth community people. We had men people themselves at this meeting. This was right after the first hostage taking. And the presentation also included the men demands of March 1st, 2006. So the presentation that I had developed was just a few weeks after this. And I gave this presentation over a period of time. The one that is passing around to some of you, I didn't anticipate so many people in the audience, was actually delivered to the International Investors Council in London. I had been invited by the Nigerian Investment Promotion Council to come to London and to talk on the Niger Delta. So when I was thinking about what to talk about today, I went over this again and I thought to myself, this is now more than 2 years old and almost none of the points have been addressed, which to me is very sad because I think the information has been out there. In 2005, the Niger Delta Peace and Security Secretariat, we did a number of background papers on the issues of the Niger Delta with suggestions for action, and virtually none of those have been implemented yet. We also had a first NNPC workshop for Niger Delta youth. This was April 2004. That's 4 years ago now. And we're still talking, and we haven't implemented any of the suggestions. If you want copies, I can give you this electronically, or maybe USIP could help us make some copies before the end of the day. But looking at the points, what I had written in June 2006 was that there were initially 550,000 barrels shut in since February, up to 800,000. According to Africa Confidential, the amount of oil shut in today is 1.36 million barrels per day. And at the time that I wrote this presentation, oil was $62 a barrel. It was at 119 just recently. I understand it's down to 113 today. So as Peter said, the problem's been magnifying and very little has been done about it. But in thinking about the causes of the problem in the Niger Delta, I think my original analysis of four conflict drivers still maintain. One is the issue of governance and good government, the lack of good governance, particularly in the region and in the country as a whole. Two, the lack of participation in the oil and gas industry. Three, the lack of social and economic development. And four, militarization of the Niger Delta. Now, there were some specific issues, for example, on governance. Everybody talks about bad governance in the Niger Delta. There were a few specific things. For example, the ijaz of the Wari local governments, Wari South, Wari North, and Wari Southwest had not participated in the elections in 1999 and 2003. And following the hostage-taking issues, we worked very hard to get these people registered in the census of March 2006, and they participated in the elections of 2007. Any of you who've seen our old newsletter, the guys down here that we had hired as election observers, a lot of them were actually Mend Boys, and they went out to Wari Southwest and they observed the elections. And we filmed this for our national television program. But as Peter said, there were not elections in many parts of the Niger Delta, as we have seen in the Bayelsa case and how the Bayelsa governorship position was overturned. Still to this day, we have very low participation of people in the Niger Delta in the oil and gas industry. There's still a low percentage of indigents who are hired by the companies. Local content and the local contracts often do not go to the people from the Delta. I think one thing we need to work on is better transparency in NNPC, for example, and I'm glad that the government, the legislature, is now looking into issues of NNPC. One thing that I had advocated a long time ago was to employ local people to rebuild the facilities that had been destroyed in the midst of kidnappings and attacks. And it's interesting that for years we were not able to reopen the pipelines around the Wari area, but once contracts were given to local people, then the pipelines are being repaired. This is a logical thing to do. We see in the area of socioeconomic development that there has been little development in the last few years. The NDDC has not received a lot of the funding that was given to it. We might well debate the effectiveness of the NDDC. I myself have a number of reservations about it as well. and the increased militarization in the region, particularly after the inter-ethnic conflict in Wari in 2003, the military came to reestablish peace and simply never went away. And certainly there is a fair amount of provocation. I think the film crew, Sweet Crude, would feel that the military presence certainly hampered their work a few weeks ago. Now, there has been a bit of progress. Like I said, some areas actually had elections in 2007, but a lot of them were very specific. There have been some oil facilities and oil contracts given out to people in the Delta. This is a change. In January 2006, one of our fellows had just spoken to an Ijaw youth leader in Delta State, and he said to us, "I'm an illegal oil bunker. I would like to be a legal oil bunker." And 2 days later, the first hostages were taken from the Niger Delta and then kept, of course, in Delta State. So he was one of the people who was helping us work on solving the problems. Other things that I think can be done, I think there needs to be international assistance in controlling arms importation, bunkering, and money laundering. As we decided long ago in the Niger Delta Peace and Security Secretariat, this goes beyond the scope of what Nigeria can do, and we need some outside assistance in this. I think the security contract should be given to communities with very careful management so that they get to people who are reliable and transparent and credible to the communities, and not just some of the normal thugs who get these contracts. There needs to be better transparency in NNPC and in NNDC. And as Peter said, I think that the use of the Delta could be put to very constructive use in massive employment projects, which could also help to build up the infrastructure. This seems to be an idea that is going in several directions. Now, as Steve said, I have interacted closely with the militant use of the Niger Delta. And in 2004, I think we had the youth in our hand. Somebody like Atteke Tom, who has again become a very fearless warlord, I believe we had in the palm of our hand. These guys were very happy to be out of the creeks. They were happy to have the fighting stopped. And for example, I went to Atteke's wedding along with a number of government and security and oil company people. It was a good era. However, politicians sidetracked the peace process and managed to divert a number of the things that we had planned away from the militants themselves into their own political cronies or members of their families. We have done a number of studies of armed groups, and we undertook one in 2006 that listed all the armed groups, the membership, the leadership, and to certain degrees, the political sponsors. I think that may have been one of the reasons why the FSS had me as a guest for 6 weeks. But what we were doing was to look for alternatives to violence, to militancy. And at that stage, we found that two-thirds of the members said that they would be willing to accept genuine employment or training if it were offered. So many of these things that are done are very tokenism. For example, in River State, at one stage, each youth was paid 10,000 naira to clean the streets. I mean, that's not any kind of employment that anybody wants to take seriously. But I think there are opportunities of drawing the youth out of violence and involving them in something else. We had set up an early warning system of 40 youths from 20 of the most conflict-prone local governments in the three core states of the Delta. A lot of these were ex-militants. A lot of them said that they were very happy for their new roles and that their communities commented, "Oh, you used to be on that side. You used to be troublesome. Now you're working with us and helping to keep the areas peaceful." Unfortunately, we had to dissemble that early warning system during our time in detention because it was simply too threatening to the security agents. There has been a great deal of payoff in the last year in particular, and I think that this has changed the situation considerably. I've been in touch with a number of people in the last few weeks in preparation for this talk. And as I used to affectionately call myself, Mama Militant, I am sad to say that I think that a lot of the militants will not go backwards. They've enjoyed too much benefit from kidnapping, still continuing with bunkering, but also government payoffs to go back. And this is particularly the fellows in the East. Some of my ex-militants had said that when the conflict came to River State, it was going to take on an entirely different nature, and indeed it has. I think that there is still some ideological basis for the action in the West, and you get some constructive youth leaders such as Tom Polo, government of Pempelu, who has played a very active role in calming people down and maintaining peace in the area. Back about August, I was talking with the Delta State government about making Tom Polo into an official peace ambassador, because he has leadership skills. A lot of these guys have fantastic skills that if they're tapped constructively, could be really good. I'm amused to receive text messages on my roaming Nigerian cell phone that Apempelu's brother, George, is running for office and that I should vote for him. I don't have the heart to tell them I'm not going to be voting for anybody in Nigeria, but it shows that people can be positively engaged in certain relationships. One last thing I would like to talk about, the role of the international community. I was thinking recently about the effort on responsibility to protect. And several years ago, I know we hosted a meeting of NGOs in Abuja to talk about what is the role of the international community in protecting its citizens. If any of you have read the Human Rights Watch report called Politics as War, that talks about the violence that happened after the 2007 elections in River State, you will see how the average citizen was terrorized by members of armed groups who were fighting each other. Now, what had happened was that some people have political patronage more than others, and those that have lost their political patronage want to be recognized, so they're in a battle for supremacy and for the benefits. In the meantime, the average person on the streets gets killed. I mean, there were dozens of people and hundreds wounded in about 6 weeks of serious street fighting in Port Harcourt in July and August of last year. I personally think the Nigerian government and the international community has a responsibility to protect citizens. And very interestingly, in the UN Security Council fourth open debate on the 20th of November 2007, that is 5-6 months ago, the two Nigerian delegates, Ambassador Aminu Wale and Ambassador Felix Anioke, said that genocide, ethnic cleansing, and crimes committed against unarmed civilians in situations of conflict, in those cases that the international community should have to rethink its responsibility to protect. I think the time is ripe. I think we waited for almost a year, and I think it's now time for the international community to step in. Thank you.
Thank you. Our third speaker is Darren Q, familiar to many of you. He's an associate professor at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. The special focus of his academic career has been interconnection between democratic institution building in Africa, and political culture, and civil conflict. He's dedicated much of his time to looking at Nigeria, and particularly the Niger Delta. Darren, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve, and thank you, David. It's a great honor to be up here with so many of my own mentors and many of you in the audience as well, who either directly or indirectly have influenced my thinking on these things and continue to. Thank you for this opportunity. Rule number one of conflict resolution is that if you're going to have peace, you need to talk. And the federal government is not so far really talking substance, I think, with the communities and leaders in the region. I told a friend of mine that, who's an activist in the region, and he said, no, it's not talk. He said, we've had enough talk. He said, we want to be heard. And I think that's a very important point, and I want to come back to the implications of this simple truism later as I get into some of the issues and what I think is a way forward. To take up Steve's initial point, I do think that we have a window of opportunity that's opening right now. And I do to agree with the previous speakers that I think it's time for international action. One, I think to help the federal government appoint an international mediator, and two, to form a contact group. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. But why is this time ripe? First is, as both Judy and Peter mentioned, the militias and the communities themselves are sending strong messages of a willingness to talk. Even MEND, although, of course, the OCA faction has a very specific demand regarding Henry OCA's release. But if you look at MEND's statements and you look at the other groups in the region, there's a strong desire to engage in a substantive discussion process. MEND itself has put out a number of different interesting proposals in this regard. And they themselves have been calling for international mediation, and they're not the only ones. MEND has called for President Carter, President Bush, even George Clooney to mediate. I actually called Clooney's publicist just to find out what he thought about that, and he has no comment. But if you look at the demands of the actors themselves, I think, now of course we're talking about a great deal of actors, and these are by no means monolithic actors, but they're tremendously negotiable elements out there that are being asked for, except for the demand for some sort of autonomy or self-determination. But frankly, I think this is just a bargaining position that most of the groups are putting out there in order to get the federal government's attention, in addition, of course, to the militancy itself. However, I do think the clock is ticking in terms of how soon folks are going to begin to think far more seriously about various self-determination alternatives. In addition, I want to echo what Judy has said about the sort of payoff approach that the federal government has taken in the past, leading to sort of periods of calm. And I think that also the clock is ticking in that regard as well, in terms of how much longer that's going to be able to be used as some sort of element of a settlement. Now, there's talk, of course, about fellowships and scholarships for some of the militants and trying to do extensive job programs, that sort of thing. I think there's amount of time in terms of how much patience folks are going to have for any sort of process like that. And if there is going to be a comprehensive bargain that would involve those, the price tag is going to go up dramatically over time as more and more groups get engaged in the sort of profitable activities that are happening. But note, it's the political leaders that really control this process in the region. And I think that, one, they're waiting to see what Abuja is going to do, and I'll explain what that means, what I mean by that in a second. And second, they're very focused on local struggles as well. In Bayelsa State, we have a rerun of the gubernatorial election coming up this month. We have local government races in Delta State happening. Now, in addition, I think the media has focused very much on the militant groups. I think it is important to note that there is some independence among some of the groups, and they are in a bargaining relationship. But the political leadership has far more resources in this relationship here. And they're the real drivers in this process. And I think that the focus on the militant groups is secondary to the political leadership. And again, none of these actors are monolithic, and we need to bring out sort of the nuances of what negotiating with them would look like. But just look at the basic numbers. 92% of Nigerians, according to the World Bank in 2006, live on less than $2 a day. 70% live on less than $1 a day. Yet Nigeria made $55 billion last year in oil wealth. So the disparity in resources that are going to the political actors here is enormous. There are vast disparities of wealth. Yes, the militants can make some money from the security funds they make from bunkering and the assistance they give in that regard. But the bulk of even the bunkering money is still in the hands of the political leadership, as folks can say far better than I can in terms of the complexities of bunkering. The guy holding the gun in the field is not the one making a tremendous amount of money off of bunkering, especially if you include the Nigerian military leadership that has some elements in this process. Now, on the federal government side, we're seeing paralysis on the one hand and indifference on the other. And I want to talk to this. Paralysis in the sense that I think the Aradua government is acutely aware of the fact that it has no sort of public legitimacy since the April 2007 elections, which were a farce, which, by the way, is the technical term that the IRI used in describing the election. Some of the other international observers used far stronger language in that regard to explain and to describe those elections. And second is that President Yar'Adua himself didn't really come to power with a real power base of his own. I think you all know sort of the story of how President Obasanjo was pivotal in President Yar'Adua coming to power. So consequently, I think the Yar'Adua government has spent much of the last year trying to get a favorable court ruling to get some sort of blessing of legitimacy in that regard, and then trying to build its own support base in the PDP by signaling to the National Assembly and to the ESCC that it's not going to step in the way of investigations of President Obasanjo and his family. And any of you following the news it must be as electrified as I am by what's happening in the National Assembly investigations, the ESCC going after the daughter of President Obasanjo, and calls for investigations of President Obasanjo himself. Clearly, of course, President Yar'Adua has said, I respect rule of law, so there's that element there, but there's no, it's certainly, I don't think, lost on some of his political-minded supporters the importance that this has on his standing in the PDP. And second, he's been trying to build alliances with the new governors, who have godfather problems of their own, in terms of trying to distance themselves from the people that put them there. And note, we've had 10 gubernatorial races overturned so far by the courts. And President Yar'Adua has been helping out these governors in the process and has been getting favors owed to him in return in this regard. Now, I think so far President Yar'Adua and his inner circle, as far as I can see it, I think there's a wariness about working with the governors too, based on the corruption concerns and others. So it's not a harmonious relationship, but at least in terms of real politique, I think the Yar'Adua administration has been very focused on trying to solidify its own position. So consequently, I think the Niger Delta peace process has taken a back seat to this clash of titans in Abuja over the last year, and the president has delegated the process to the Secretary General of the Federation, Ambassador Babagana Kingabe, and the Vice President. But the SGF, Kingabe, has been very much focused on these Abuja power struggles in addition to the Niger Delta peace process, so he's got a lot on his plate. And, let's face it, there's a lot of debate within sort of the chattering classes in Abuja that if the president's election is annulled by the Supreme Court, that Babagana Kingabe could be a potential replacement for President Yar'Adua if some of the magnates of the PDP decide they want to move against President Yar'Adua. And if President Yar'Adua doesn't run in 2011, then certainly there's a good debate to be made that the North deserves a second term, so to speak, since the South just had two. And he is, again, a leading candidate in that regard. So depending upon which rumor mill you talk to, there's clear that, regardless of the rumors or not, the SGF is clearly a very important political figure. And then second, as I've mentioned, the administration itself is waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on whether or not it can stay in office. And if you look at the panel that the Chief Justice has picked to look at the Supreme Court, to look at the case that's before the Supreme Court now, I don't think that the Yar'Adua administration can sit tight and comfortable. You have some very credible judges in that panel who are going to rule on this matter. And, it's still an open question as to whether the Supreme Court is going to rule against it. If you look at what the Supreme Court has said about the River State decision or some of the other decisions that have come across, they're clearly energized and angry about what happened in April. And I would be concerned if I were sitting in Aso Rock right now. They were clearly buoyed by the tribunal decision we had back in February that was, a blanket support for the April 2007 election. I think clearly the Supreme Court is going to have other thoughts on the matter. I think the chances are still in favor of them ruling that in favor of President Yar'Adua, but who knows? I think it's very much clear. We can debate that later, and I can speculate more if you like. The Vice President, on the other hand, initially I think won some kudos for speaking to the militants last year, and he also bridged peace with the former governor of Bayelsa State, Alamasega, and of course with Asari. But he's had this on-again, off-again fight with the current governor, who has just had his electoral mandate overturned of Bayelsa State, to control the PDP in Bayelsa. He's also trying to expand his own network. He's thinking about his own sort of political future, I'm sure. And there's been a lot of talk about sort of potential debate among the PDP magnates over whether, if the election is annulled, whether they should try to dump the vice president and get somebody else from the region. So I think he's insecure about his own political future in this larger insecurity about the administration. So naturally, I think he's had his mind on this larger political struggle in Abuja as well. In addition, I also want to note, I think there's a very disturbing indifference, which I think both Peter and Judy alluded to, in Abuja. That there is, and to folks that I talk to as well, I think there's a growing attitude among the Abuja elite that eventually all of the onshore oil is going to be shut down, but that's okay because we can live with the offshore oil and gas, and with the high price of gas, we can live. It'll offset those prices, and it'll offset our loss. And I think if you just look at the strong focus that the Aradu administration has put on the Gulf of Guinea process, hoping to get the larger security strategy offshore, and pushing for strong U.S. naval assistance and so on. I think not only is this irresponsible in terms of avoiding the onshore issues, I think it's also just foolish in the sense that to expect that the militants are not going to be able to hit these offshore capacities. It's clear they've already made clear that they can do it, and I think they are vulnerable to this, and far more vulnerable than I think Abuja is thinking. In addition, I think there's been some disunity among the mediators as well, which both Peter and Judy have talked about. And I mentioned, of course, between sort of the vice presidential initiative, the SGF has his initiative, we also have the governors have started their own local initiatives because of the lack of sort of leadership from the center. We've had some interesting successes in Bayelsa State, for instance. The governor there, Governor Silva, has managed to build essentially a very strong sort of ceasefire network. There's only been one sort of violation of that, to my knowledge, since December or so far. The Delta State governor has undertaken different initiatives. The River State governor is in a different category in that regard. But we have local initiatives as well, so we don't really have a unified mediation process on the ground. But as I said, I think that we've got a window of opportunity that's opening now for a number of reasons, and I think it's going to stay open until roughly January 2010, only because that's my guess as to when the politicking really steps up for the 2011 election, which is happening. So we're looking at roughly an 18-month window here, which, you know, is not a lot of time. And I really think something needs to be done sooner rather than later in this regard. Why do I think a window is opening? First is I think that that President Yar'Adua was buoyed by the tribunal ruling. And as I said before, I think if I were betting, I'd put my money on the Supreme Court saying that the election stank, but that, you know, we need to live with it, sort of much as they did in 2003, only perhaps far more pointed in that regard. There's a number. My reasoning for that I can tell you later in the discussion if you're interested. And so we may get a ruling as early as July. I'm hearing from folks it may go as late as September because the Ardua folks are going to try to draw this out as long as possible just in case it goes against them. But we'll see. The Supreme Court, again, I think we can be fairly certain, has its own mind on these issues. But I do think that the tribunal ruling has given some new momentum to the Yar'Adua administration in this. And then once we do get a Supreme Court ruling, if it does go in the president's favor, I think we may see a cabinet reshuffle, and we may see actually some sort of renewed initiative where the presidency decides, okay, now we can go after our plan for Nigeria. And then if you also, of course, include that with, I think, the growing position and strength of the president within the PDP, I think a number of these things are going to work together nicely to give him perhaps an opportunity if he wants to seize it. Second is that I think that President Yar'Adua is beginning to rethink having delegated the peace process to the vice president for a number of reasons. And I think if you just look at when he was flown to Germany for medical treatment 2 weeks ago, the newspapers are reporting that he handed over the reins of government to the National Security Advisor and to the SGF rather than to the vice president. I think that shows you at least where his sense of who's in charge and who he trusts in this regard. I'm also hearing sort of just some discussion about that, you know, internally. Whether or not he turns to the vice president, I think there are some number of reasons that, you know, the vice president is the vice president and certainly should have national concerns himself anyway. And I hope he stays in a supporting role. I don't think he should be sidelined by any stretch of the imagination, but I think in terms of who should be the center person, there's some important questions to raise about this. And the president seems to be thinking in those directions, or at least his inner circle seems to be sending those messages in that regard. And what I hope this means is that the president himself is going to be showing greater attention to the Niger Delta. I'll explain why I see that as so important in a minute. Second, as we've mentioned, 50% of production is now shut in at the moment. I've heard different numbers in this regard. There was this, I think, sense last year that we could live with a 25% shut in indefinitely. I think 50% shut in gets people's attention in a way that 25 maybe didn't. And I also think that the president has very importantly signaled an openness to international mediation. He's asked Secretary General Ban Ki-moon for help in the Niger Delta. That's different than a direct invitation for mediation, of course, but certainly a willingness for international help in this regard. He met President Carter in early April. Now, there was no official request for mediation help from President Carter, but my understanding from the official releases is talking about sort of Guinea worm and elections were the main issues. But nonetheless, I think it's a sign of a relationship there, which I think is very important. And remember that MEND has asked for President Carter to mediate. I think actually this is a problem, and if anyone out there speaks to MEND, if you could perhaps recommend to them that they stop being specific about who their mediators are, because I think this invites the federal government, and it's a face, they lose face if they then, you know, give in to MEND's demands in this regard. So perhaps a more blanket request for international mediation is better in this regard. So there's still that problem from the Carter Center's perspective in terms of their role in any sort of process if they do take up the invitations from the Delta. And fifth is that the gubernatorial initiatives are making some headway, as I mentioned. So I think there are some pockets of progress here on the ground that could also be energized by an international effort. Now, also, we do have now coming, the federal government has turned and invited Ambassador Gambari, who is at the UN now, to come and to head up a conference on peace in the Niger Delta, at which point we're likely to see the unveiling with the hope of getting sort of UN blessing on the matter of the so-called Akachukwu plan, named for the Vice President's Niger Delta desk officer, who's not a Niger Delta indigent, a business consultant and associate of the Vice President. The plan in itself incorporates many sort of basic elements that conflict resolution activists have been calling for a while, a three-tiered process of mediation efforts at the national, state, and local levels, some sort of stakeholder engagement and assessment process, and some sort of National Assembly action, though it's very vague about that particular point. There's discussions, of course, from the last time around that there was a national dialogue on the matter, or perhaps sort of 17 to 25% resource control, but this is very unclear, and clearly the local actors have been calling for 50% or more. I think President Yar'Adua has got to be sort of hesitant to raise this issue with the North, given his sort of weak position within the PDP. But perhaps after the Supreme Court ruling, he's going to feel in a stronger place to actually get down to talking about this real sort of north-south-south divide over this question of resource control and the percentage issue. But already I'm worried that there are signs that the Gambari conference may be window dressing again, and this is a very worrisome point that we need to raise now, is that many actors from the region who are some of the most credible actors have not been invited. And I've been talking to sort of activists in the region. They're saying, you know, it's kind of becoming a badge of honor now to not be invited to this Gambari conference to show that, you know, you must be a real, you know, a really important person if you haven't been invited. I think this has to change. And I think also the Akachukwu plan itself has not involved key actors from the region in its development. And so in addition, we've had infighting within the Yar'Adua administration, as I've mentioned, regarding the development of this plan. So I think some actors are going to reject it on principle. Others feel disassociated from it. I think if the Gambari conference is not preceded by some sort of more open consultation in the region and over the agenda itself, it may do more harm than good. And I think Abuja, as I said at the outset, needs to hear more and talk less. What could that look like to end in terms of the international role? This is why I think a strong international role is needed, is that I think Abuja, on the one hand, where I think, you know, the ball is in the presidency's court to move forward on this, but I think they are hesitant to go as far as they need to go, and I think international actors are the ones that can sort of push this forward. And now is the time, and I think over this next 18 months in particular, whereby there will be some sensitivity from the Yar'Adua government on this, which is why I think first there needs to be some sort of a contact group form, sort of the group of friends model, so to speak, of the United States, the UK, the UN. I think the Carter Center should be invited to be involved in this. And note, this will also sort of blunt the face-saving issue in terms of rather than having President Carter himself or the Carter Center himself and to force that down the Yar'Adua administration's throat, if they're part of a larger contact group, then they can play sort of a constructive role without Abuja having to sort of lose face on that matter. And then also, of course, you know, we haven't even asked the Carter Center if they want to mediate in this regard. I think that's another issue. I also would want to raise out there for others who follow these issues more closely whether China should be part of such a contact group. I think that's an opening question. What the contact group can do is it can recommend mediators to the federal government respectfully. Not force it down their throat, but to respectfully say, look, here's a short list of people that we think could do really good. I have my sort of list of favorites on that one we can talk about, but I think all of you do as well. And that also the contact group can support the mediation effort in terms of advice, funding, and can also link to the Gulf of Guinea security process. By the way, I think the Gulf of Guinea process should be kept separate for a number of reasons, and we can talk about that in the question session. I think also that, however, the contract group can pressure the federal government to move forward on the process. And I think Abuja is still going to be taking baby steps on these matters, and they need to be taking large strides. And the internationals can put a little bit of pressure at key moments and over the next 18 months to make it far more in the interest of Abuja to do so. And note, without the contact group, you know, let's not fool ourselves. Abuja is going to be very adept at playing the internationals off against one another, as we've seen all across, you know, other sort of mediations, and there are folks here who can speak better to that than I can. And so without this sort of contract group and unity among the internationals, I think that's going to be critically important for this kind of pressure. In addition, just from the perspective of the Americans, as we all know, there's going to be an Obama administration in 2009. God willing. And so clearly there's going to be a change of government in early 2009, and whoever comes into office is going to take time to sort of get their feet on the ground. And I hope the Bush administration, if they can get something institutionally there, will provide some continuity in this regard in terms of Nigeria. In addition, Judy wanted to I think you mentioned about the sort of the IMC model. And then also in terms of an important liaison with the international oil companies. Okay, 2 minutes. I'm wrapping up. Second is, I think, as I said, I think the contact group can push for a strong centralized mediator, an international one. So in this first, we'll unify the mediation team. We've got a lot of, as I said, different mediators on the ground, and the local actors can sort of, you know, pick and choose their mediation process, and they work against each other, they compete with each other. This is not good. But, you know, by saying that there needs to be an international mediator, there's also going to have to be solid local partners that are part of this process. And I think in questions we can talk about, you know, what that might look like. Second, and just as or more important, is that an international mediator can talk to President Yar'Adua. And as I say, you know, President Yar'Adua has really been the missing link in this whole process. And when you look at Nigeria's centralized political system, even given sort of the tenuous base he's had in the PDP, he still holds enormous resources. And he must be engaged in this process. The mediator has to be able to talk to him, to get him on the phone, and to be able to talk and to engage him and to say, look, what do you want and what can you do in this? And in order to strengthen the hand of the mediator as well, so that local actors look at the mediator and see the mediator as credible. If the federal government's not engaged seriously in this regard, even if we get a great international mediator, I think local actors are going to begin to start thinking again about their alternatives in this sense. And just to add in that regard, an international mediator, one of the reasons a lot of actors is calling for one is because an international actor can infuse some credibility back into the process. There's a lot of disillusionment with Abuja, and if Abuja just appoints another mediator, and I'm afraid that Ambassador Gambari may fall into that category, and I worry about that, and I'd like to discuss and debate that with you in the questions if you're interested, that an international can kind of re-energize local faith that, okay, something's going to happen here, and it's so desperately needed at this time. And as I said, an international mediator can push when the federal government doesn't want to, especially if this is an eminent person in this way. And can also sort of engage and focus the gubernatorial initiatives if the presidency is engaged, or as sort of a backdrop, if the presidency still drags its heels, they can still engage the local process and at least make some marginal gains in the interim until Abuja gets back on track. And then, okay. And lastly, a couple quick points is I would recommend a Niger Delta task force, a public consultation process, and then the issue of election reform. So thank you for the extra time. Sorry. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. You've all been very patient. We have a microphone in the front here for questions and comments. We do have with us here today a representative of the EJAW Youth Council. Perhaps you'd like to open up with very brief comments from your perspective. Please introduce yourself. There's a microphone right here.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dr. Chris Akiyo, and I'm president of the EJAW Youth Council with over about 4.5 million youth in the Niger Delta. And of course, some of the agitators are members of the EJAW Youth Council. And I'm here because I think the only way to peace is peace itself. Thank you very much. And then possibly I just want to make two or three comments on some of the issues I've been listening to. I'm quite impressed with the concerns of those of you here on the issues of the Niger Delta, basically because we live with it. We're inside of it. Judith has been able to get a complete picture of the situation, and she understands what the government and the people are doing in Nigeria back there. What we need to know is that until the rest of the world get involved and put pressure on the Nigerian government, we're still doing what's called wound dressing. We've been having talk shops since 1937, pre-independence, and we keep having talk shops. And they make it very big all the time. They put it everywhere and give impression that we're getting there. But in summary, they never do anything. Whatever we're going to have again now is going to be another talk shop until there's international mediation. Currently, I lead the group that is talking with the government, and in that group, we're about 13. And I have a representative from possibly the Tompolos camp, the Ateke Toms camp, and the other groups, and we're talking with government. We had put a stalemate on the issue of a summit until certain actions are taken. And we give them about 6 roadmap to peace, and one of them was for them to make a pronouncement of a developmental emergency for the Niger Delta to fast-track development, because what we have in the Niger Delta is a sorry state. It's a scenario where you have doom in the midst of boom. That's how you can describe it. People live in an environment where there's so much oil and gas, so much money, and they can't access it, they can't have access to it, they can't even talk about it, because there is a superior force from the government that is actually militarizing the region. See, militancy didn't just start. In 1998, precisely 11th of December, a group of young youths met together and said there was a need to stand up for their rights, and that formed the EJAW Youth Council. But you dare to protest, and then the government brings out its armory on you, and they send the soldiers after you. Not the police, the soldiers after you, the armed force after you, and they maim and kill people. And so the youth decided to go back and get themselves prepared for challenges. And that's where the whole militarization started. Now we have a vicious cycle. We want jobs. We've created a scenario where jobs cannot be created, and then there's crisis everywhere. Until the world sits down and sincerely put pressure, not even to side talk it, you have to put pressure, international pressure. And when it becomes necessary, put sanctions. Nigerian state will not do anything. They respect the international community. And for this talk shop, certainly, until we have the presence of the UN, certainly the results, the outcome of this talk shop will not go anywhere. We are constantly being perturbed, threatened, assaulted. I have been brutalized recently, exactly February 16th. I was going for a peace initiative to institute a democratic process for the Youth Council so that we can be responsible for our activities and coordinate them within the constitutional provision. But the Joint Task Force, even after I've introduced myself, used weapons on me, dislocated my left arm, and beat me blue-black. And I had petitioned the government, and they are pretending to do something about it. But that is the scenario every day. People who are killed by the Nigerian army that is supposed to protect the Nigerian state under the auspices of taking instructions from government. And the Joint Task Force in the Niger Delta right now is part of the problem. They have three chains of command: the army hierarchy, the multinational, that's the big oil, and then the individual. So, and they decide what the target is. So if they look at your face and they don't like you, you become the target. And that's why they could pick her easily and send her to the prison for 6 weeks. But sorry about that anyway. In summary, this institution needs to close rank with the EJAW Youth Council. Somebody said here that there's possibly no unifying organization to moderate between men and the other groups. Well, the EJAW Youth Council is the umbrella organization that is talking to everybody, and I can reach everybody in a quick. The recent fragile peace you're seeing is because we're trying to talk to the people, and we're getting them to key in and trying to open up a new window of hope for everybody. It's quite fragile because as the clock is ticking, if nothing is done to galvanize and strengthen it, there will be an eruption like a volcano that will probably be out of control in the Niger Delta. And certainly it will have a boomerang effect in the world, because the Niger Delta is strategically positioned in terms of oil and gas to help solve the world's energy problem. I want to say that I want to crave your indulgence to do all that is possible within the lines of peace to help the Nigerian state achieve the required roadmap to chart to solving our problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and try and keep your statement to 2 minutes.
My name is Chief Sam Udofia. I have been involved. I happen to come from Akwa Ibom State. Mm-hmm. That is where Mobil operates. Now, it's a long thing. I've been involved in this thing for a very long time. And from my experience, I know that no matter what we are going to do, there will be no peace unless we address the economic situation. Judy, Ruth, as somebody who is who was born there, insight or something, it's just fantastic. I don't want to repeat what you were saying. When we talk about resource control, you remember it started at 3%, then it went to 7%. Then it looked as if it was not going to be. There was a governor, this guy is from here, you know, he studied here, who was a governor of Akwa Ibom State. They call him the disciple of doom, the disciple of this thing. And we organized for him to come down and meet Black Caucus here. And the Black Caucus did something, invited him, get into the White House, and so on. And something happened. So some people may be thinking, we are now receiving 17%. Somebody did it. Something happened. And it can be traced to Black Caucus, the White House, or something. In other words, I'm saying to you people that if international organizations, especially United States, Britain, and United Nations go in, it would help considerably.
Thank you.
Now, my proposal is that since Nigeria is having 51% and the oil company is having 49%, I floated the idea of giving the owners of the oil a part ownership of the oil if we want to have peace. In other words, once, you know, Peter Drucker said, you support what you help make. If we give federal government 35% and give oil company 35%, then give the land owners 20%. From my experience, I've talked with a whole bunch of them or something, there will be a lot of support. And finally, I want to let the oil companies do what Mobil is doing. Mobil oil goes into Akwa Ibom, get involved in tarring the roads, get involved in giving these children scholarship, get involved in building this thing. Some oil companies are not doing that in other areas.
Thank you. We're going to take a few more comments, and then we'll come back to our panelists. Please. Please identify yourself.
My name is Yao Adutu. I'm an independent journalist. I would like to know the attitude of other Nigerians outside of the Delta area towards the whole process in the peace or the violence.
Nigerians within Nigeria.
Nigerians within Nigeria. And the basis of my question is that resource allocation envy among the regions in Nigeria go back before discovery of oil. And it looks like that is what is carrying forward. And my particular concern is also because Ghana is about to have commercial oil. And I'm scared.
Thank you. Joe.
Hi, Taylor Siebold from U.S. Institute of Peace. I want to pick up on this dual dynamic that all of you talked about between greed and grievance in the Delta, that some of the violence is politically motivated, others is other actors are criminally motivated, and there's a crossover between those at some point. The solutions that you all suggested seem to me to address primarily the political motivations. I was struck by Judy's comment that she doesn't think that a lot of the people involved in the militia at this point are interested in coming back in to talk. It's different than it was a few years ago in that regard. What is it that's going to address the criminal aspect, and to what extent are those who are driven by criminal interests under the control of anybody who's driven by political interests? Thanks.
Thanks. Okay, let's take the other three, and then we'll come back. Yes,
okay. Oge Okoye with the National Endowment for Democracy. Having just returned from the Niger Delta, from Port Harcourt, a lot of the groups we met with over there are really impressed with the work they do, a lot of our grantees out there. But however, they raised the concern that a lot of attention is placed on what the militias do in the Niger Delta, and very little is placed on the work that these civil society organizations actually carry out over there. They do very dynamic work out there. And one of the groups we support out there works on the issue of gas flaring in the Niger Delta. And knowing that the Nigerian legislature is slowly moving from becoming a rubber stamp legislature to actually one that makes decisions, what type of pressure can the international community put on the Nigerian legislature, not so much as pressure, but how can the international community work with the Nigerian legislature to have them pass the Gas Flaring Act? Because they've had deadlines in the past, and a recent deadline is now set for 2008. Mm-hmm. And how can the international community work with the Nigerian legislature? Secondly, another issue they raised was on the issue of small arms in the Niger Delta. Is the international community, especially organizations like CSIS here in the United States, is there any work being done on documenting the number of small arms that actually goes into Nigeria every year?
Thank you. Okay, let's have two more.
I'm John McDonald from the Institute for Multi-Track Diplomacy. I would just, a point of information, talk about the role of non-governmental organizations in the Delta, which has really not been touched on very much. My institute has been working in the Delta, and last year we were able to train in conflict resolution skills 81 militants who responded 3 weeks later by saying, we have now released 25 Filipino prisoners so that they could go back home. In other words, the role of the NGO community can be a powerful one, working with the people. We're invited by the people, we're working with the people. And in fact, we're having this evening at our institute, for any people from the Niger Delta, something called the Niger Delta Peace Forum, which we helped to create in Port Harcourt, and now we have an office in our institute here in Roslyn. Thank you.
My name is Dr. Bogudet, and I'm a doctoral candidate in the Department of English and the Program in Theory and Criticism at the University of Washington. And Okoye asked one of the questions that has been agitating my mind, which is that when is the international community really going to put pressure on the oil companies to stop gas flaring in the Niger Delta? The second question is that I think that for a real international mediation process to take place, Ambassador Gambari is not the right candidate, because he is part of the problem. He is part of the federal government. We need an impartial, arbitrator. So I think that this body should put pressure on the federal government to replace Ambassador Gambari with somebody from outside of Nigeria who will come in and be an impartial arbitrator. And then finally, in terms of resource, this is control. I think that this is something that we should be very concerned about, because part of the democratic process and, you know, part of the checks and balances that make democracy work is, you know, by, you know, dividing duties to the different different parts of the District Federation. Resources to control, at least 30% should go to the states, 20% to the local district government areas. So, in other words, in the oil and gas sector, the local district government area should be able to have some form of resource control, in addition to the and the state district government as well, and the federal government. I would have said 100% this is resources and control, but I'm not this naive about it. Part of the reason why the federal government doesn't want to let go is that the oil and gas sector is a huge patronage sector. So I am not this naive, you know, this about that. So let them say, okay, keep 50%. But I think that the international community should be able to put pressure on them to cede some of that to the state and the local government area so that they can tax. They can place, you know, taxes on what the other district sectors.
Thank you. All right, we have just two more interventions. Please be brief. We're going to come back to our speakers. Okay. Thank you.
My name is Bina Yidowe. I am an Ijo, indigent, and I work with a venture fund in Washington, D.C. I think my biggest problem about what is going on in Nigeria and with my people is the fact that people talk about security. There can be no security without development. My people live like rats. The water we drink is like light coffee. Judy, I'm sure you've seen that. Light black coffee. That's the water we drink, that's the water we bathe with, that's the water we do everything with. I believe that if the international community can put pressure on the Nigerian government to develop, fast-track development in the communities, in the area, there will be peace. And we would not need to budget $50 billion for peace while we're budgeting $7 million for development. And I think that the international community can come in and pressure the Nigerian government about that. And that is the reason why you have so many people doing nothing. Economic empowerment, fast-track development, no infrastructure. Until that is done, I think people will continue to be unhappy and will continue to see the situation that we see today. And like Chris Akia just said, this is a powder. This is something that's going to blow up in our faces if we don't do anything about it. Thank you very much.
We have one more speaker and one more comment, and then we're going to turn back to our folks. We have to wait. Go ahead.
I'm Jonas Horner. I'm currently with the Eurasia Group, but I used to work with Judy and the Delta with the Small Arms Survey in Geneva. But I wanted to address something you mentioned earlier. You suggested that perhaps local communities should be responsible for their own security and for providing for their own security. Given sort of the fiasco of Abia State and the Bokassi boys, how can we put together a rule of law program that ensures that they act within these guidelines?
Thank you. I want to come back to our speakers. Just to remind, you know, we started with the question of has anything changed? With special reference to on-the-ground circumstances in the Delta, with respect to what's going on in Abuja and within the political class and with what's happening in the international domain. I don't see any clear answers coming forward in any of those three areas. The picture in terms of what's going on the ground remains one of continued fragmentation, proliferation of criminally driven violence, yet it hasn't reached a point where it's destabilizing to the degree that you have alarm bells going off. In Abuja, there's, as Darren has said, there's been a back and forth about who within the inner circle has lead responsibilities on this. None of the parties who've been designated by the president to take the lead have, as far as I can tell, done much of anything. That doesn't seem to be a priority, and there doesn't seem to be a momentum or a political process coming out of Abuja. And then on the international side, while Darren, you said you think the next 18 months is a window. Who is it that's going to, where is this going to be nested? I mean, the UN, the Commonwealth, the AU, ECOWAS, some independent ad hoc coalition. Where is that? I mean, simply saying that there should be an international initiative is one thing. There's got to be some powerful set of factors that pick this up and make it a priority and are welcomed to do so, and are welcomed by powerful interests within Nigeria. And so far, those are missing elements. So if you could, perhaps we start with Peter, and we've had a number of other issues raised by our speakers here this morning, but if we can bring the discussion back to, is anything different, and as we look out today.
Okay. Is this on?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, you can hear me. Good. Okay, let me take a couple of these questions quickly. Broadly, I think there's a fundamental problem, which is that we're in currently a sustainable, unfortunately sustainable equilibrium in terms of the conflict. The new numbers from the last couple of weeks on shut-ins certainly raise the threshold rather dramatically. But even with those numbers, even with almost a 50% shut-in of Nigerian production, at $120 per barrel, $50 or $60 billion in foreign reserves, budget surpluses, and an appreciating naira against the dollar, this is quite sustainable for the Nigerian government. It's just storage. It's just deferred income in a highly income-rich circumstance. Last year, Royal Dutch Shell posted charges against lost production of $716 million. Sounds like a big loss for Royal Dutch Shell, except that their profits were $8.2 billion. And so in the current environment, the losses sustained by the companies, the losses sustained by the government are tolerable. And consequently, there's an equilibrium in which the politicians are able to raise revenues to sustain their patronage networks and to pay off their militias. The militias are able to sustain a subsistence strategy, and they don't suffer any significant harm from the military, because they're roughly evenly matched with the military. They have bazookas, they have surface-to-air missiles, they have RPGs, they have heavy machine guns. They can outgun most military units that are currently arrayed against them. So the militants are really under no particular pressure to relent. The governments in the states can sustain this. And I think it's very important to recognize, I think Darren's point was especially useful, that while there is this proliferation and criminalization of violence in the Niger Delta, let's be clear about how it's organized and the crucial and pivotal role of the party organizations and the governors in raising, paying, tolerating, and encouraging militias in the region. And so that raises another question for the central government, and that is, how do you rein in local authorities who really are trying to establish their own fiefdoms and are actually being fairly successful at it? In a circumstance in which the president has very weak authority, he was brought up by the same party kingmakers as the governors, and in a decentralized system of rigging, the governors have their own power bases in the states. It's very difficult to see how Abuja can essentially get a grip on this situation and either unseat or bypass or discipline the governors. So those are critical issues. Given the unfortunate and sustainable equilibrium domestically, I really think that the message that's becoming quite clear from this discussion is probably with a locus in the United Nations system.
there needs to be some rather forceful and assertive external inducement. But also the U.S. and the U.K., who have serious interests in the situation, need to get involved in a more effective way. When we talk about gas flaring, legislative roles in Nigeria, well, you know, we have a couple of NDI programs with the Nigerian legislature, helping them develop their committee system and their research capabilities and so forth, but that's not a serious amount of resources or engagement on the table. The United States has basically walked back from democracy and governance in Nigeria, as in the rest of Africa, in favor of putting its money in the HIV/AIDS basket, education, and other social sectors. Until we get seriously engaged again on the governance side, we're not going to have the kinds of initiative and the kinds of leverage that we need in order to put pressure on the Nigerian government. Last point, there are many, but I think this just addresses many concerns. Last point was the question from, I think, the Ghanaian journalist about attitudes throughout Nigeria. We have some survey data on this from Afrobarometer. 75% of people in the Niger Delta believe there should be more resources for communities where the resources are located. Unfortunately, the mirror image is that outside the Delta, 75% of Nigerians believe just the opposite, that the federal government should have most of the revenue. So, unfortunately, the minorities in the Niger Delta have a minority position in terms of Nigerian public opinion. That's not to say that there isn't some room for negotiation in terms of the current 13%, but clearly the delivery of that money is critical. Finally, on Ghana, yes, Ghana has currently declared proven reserves of 600 million barrels of oil. That's likely to go up. You say you're concerned. To quote a movie promotional phrase some years ago, be afraid, be very afraid. Oil and democracy don't easily mix, and Ghana needs to be very forward-looking and planful, as we often say, in thinking about how to manage this potential windfall.
Judy.
Good, thank you. I've been working in the field of conflict management, peace and development in Nigeria for about 15 years now. And one of our first experiences was that it can't be just civil society alone, government must be involved. So for example, our early interventions into Fawa Balewa, Zango Kataf, a lot of the middle belt conflicts, we felt that it was not sustainable because the government wasn't involved. And that's one of the reasons why I went back to government about 2000 to try to get civil society and government working together. And it happened to be that Obasanjo and I had started a National Corps of Mediators back when he was a civilian, looking at the role of respected civilians in handling community conflicts. But I think there's a real problem in Nigeria where the government doesn't feel that the civil society is its partner, that they feel that we are the enemy. And this is so ironic because, for example, in 2001, we started an early warning system with the SSS. And part of the whole Niger Delta peace and security strategy was that we had deputy governors on our things. We had SSS, the police, the JTF, the oil companies, community leaders, EFCC, NDDC, etc. And after a wonderful initiative, people began to get uncomfortable about what we knew. So I think the message is civil society can do wonderful things, but unless government is involved in a non-threatening way, it's never going to be sustainable. And addressing Jonas's comment about how communities can protect themselves, up until my detention, we were working very closely with the Delta State government. James Fennell, the DFID Regional Conflict Advisor, and I had sat down with the state government before they were actually went into office and designed a number of attempts to try to consolidate peace and development in the state. One of the ideas was that that led into the Waterway Security Commission. And you may have noticed that this was set up straight away early June by the Delta State government and included a number of
youth activists themselves, including my favorite hostage taker, who called me up and he said, "No, Mom, I'm on this committee, you know, and we're doing this, and we're trying to protect our waterways." Delta State was also trying to put together a community surveillance type of thing. I think this is possible. And ultimately, the communities have to guarantee their own safety. That was the idea behind the Obasanjo National Corps of Mediators. The people are the ones who suffer when there's insecurity on the ground. The people themselves must be involved in providing the security. On the same issue of the small arms survey does have a report out about small arms in the Niger Delta, and I think there are great concerns. We did an updated study for the Delta State government on what had happened since our study of 2006, and the results were horrifying. There is a much bigger problem on the ground than most of us actually have the facts and figures for. One other comment I would like to make is that the environment must change. You can go and do all the training that you want, and this is one thing. I mean, I've done 250 training workshops in Nigeria over the last 15 years. Training itself doesn't work if you don't have the environment change. We brought the guys out of violence in River State in 2004. We had a wonderful ride for about 6 months until the politicians sidetracked the process. The avenues for alternatives dried up. The scholarships were not paid. The people were not allowed to enter the military, the police, etc. Even the initiatives of Obasanjo with that Niger Delta committee, whatever he set up. If you sat there and listened on television, people talked about how many people were brought into the military, the police, etc. But these were friends of politicians. These were not the guys who really needed these jobs. So the environment must change if we're able to bring people out of violence and keep them out of it. They must have some real alternatives.
Thank you. Darren.
Thank you. I think just, Steve, to begin with some of your questions about what's changed, I think sort of my central issue is that I'm curious as to whether we are seeing a at least a small shift in attitude from the president himself and from the presidency. Though I think, as you rightly point out, is that I think their response to it has still been, let's hold a conference, which, as folks have said, I don't think that in itself is acceptable or sufficient. I was hoping that maybe the 50% shut-in would also be something of an incentive, but I think, as Peter and others have said, I mean, there's some question as to whether even that will be enough of a motivation. But third, I do think the appointment of Ambassador Gambari at least opens a door. I think in and itself, as one of the speakers said, is not the answer, but it suggests at least an open door towards connecting with the United Nations. And this, I think, gets into your point about where to nestle such a contact group. I mean, I think the UN and the U.S. the United States and the U.K. are probably the most energized about this and would be the sort of core of any such group. But perhaps some question about whether the UN could be a beginning place to nestle such an organization, such a group. And connected perhaps with Ambassador Gambari, though I think the speaker very importantly points out, you know, the concerns on the ground about Gambari's loyalties. But I think that precisely because if his appointment shows that he has the confidence of President Yar'Adua, it's that confidence of the president which is a very important element that we need to engage in this process, for precisely the concern you're raising, is that if we don't get the confidence of the president engaged in some sort of process, it's not going to go very far. So, you know, love him or hate him, if Gambari does have the ear of the president on this, at least for now, then perhaps that's an opportunity to begin some sort of a contact group structure and to open the mediation question. And then from there, if in the short term or even in the long term, if we see that the UN is not able to be a point for change in this regard, I do think once you have a contact group established, then the UN and the UK can then move to take more assertive control over it. And of course, as we all know how the UN works, the US and the UK certainly has quite a bit of say anyway in what's happening within that institution to some degree. So I'm seeing at least Gambari as an opening towards trying to move this forward. I think one sign of sort of gauging as to how serious the Nigerian government is about this is whether or not Abuja appoints a interministerial task force. And I think this is something that the contract group should push for. I'm not talking about another commission. I think that, again, is part of the problem. I think a real interministerial task force, which has got tasked with real authority to actually make decisions on these matters. Quickly on civil society, I think that in terms of getting the National Assembly to move on some of these issues from an international donor perspective, I think the donors put a lot of focus on the NGO movement, which I think is important and fine, and I'm not suggesting shifting funds, but I think funds should be increased to connect to the big civil society groups, the trade unions, the religious groups, the bar, who have tremendous amount, I think, of sway and can get people on the streets in a way that the smaller NGO movement has some trouble getting. And I think that the donors have a problem working with these bigger groups because naturally the bigger groups have their own agendas. I think the donors need to sort of try to engage them more substantially in engaging the National Assembly. And then last, just in terms of the resource control question, I think that this is intimately connected to the elections question. One thing I think that the North, and not just the North, but other actors, and this gets to the question of sort of where the rest of Nigeria is looking, they look and they see the amount of money that is already going into the Niger Delta, and they say, well, what are your governors doing with all this money? And so I think that it undermines the local resource control argument when they look at, you know, just the amount. I mean, River State was making $1 billion in alone in 2006. I don't think that's, you know, that I think the counter argument, it says, well, you know, give us resource control and we'll deal with our governors in our own way. But naturally, I think it still undermines the argument. And so election reform is a central plank in this discussion.
We'll take the three more questions or comments and then we'll close. Four, and that's the end. Go ahead.
All right, good morning. My name is Dafe Ide. I'm from the Niger Delta. I'm actually from Wari, to be precise. My question here is that I have actually lived over 30 decades in the Niger Delta. I was born and raised in the Niger Delta. I pretty much know what's actually going on in the Niger Delta in terms of the development. I agree with Bina, who actually said the condition of living in the Niger Delta is actually very deplorable. We're talking about we don't have infrastructures. With respect to the oil companies, they've actually tried once in a while to come up with some initiatives to say they are trying to empower the youth. They are trying to actually train them on handworks. Now, but the greatest question I have for the international community is this. What efforts, what measures have they actually tried to put in place to actually put pressure on the Nigerian government to see that we have the basic infrastructures in place, as little as electricity? Because that's one of the greatest concerns we have in the Niger Delta or in the Nigeria as a whole. We have people who have been trained on different things. You have welders who have been given machineries by oil companies to say, well, as part of our social responsibility to the community, we're training, we're putting you through this process. You have sewing machines for youth, for ladies and everything. But these people don't have electricity to power this equipment.
Okay, you want to wind up? We're gonna.
So one other question goes to Darren. You talked about one of the solutions for the Niger Delta is getting a Niger Delta Task Force. Now, I wanted to highlight, give us more emphasis on that, the composition of that task force. Thank you.
My limit of three has turned out to be six, so please be brief.
Good morning. My name is Tammy Sims, and I'm the producer of Sweet Crude, and I'm one of the four filmmakers that was recently detained by the JTF and the SSS on April 12th in Nigeria. We spent a week there, and it became clear to us, you know, sort of through that process, that there are some holes in the claim that the Nigerian government has reached a place of legitimate open democracy. And we are on our second visit with the U.S. Embassy. We were told during the visit that over the course of our detainment that bilateral relations between Nigeria and the U.S. government had taken a couple of steps back. And so we're really interested in making sure that that doesn't continue to happen. And our time certainly further resolved our interest in seeing resolution and change in the Niger Delta. We began the project in November of 2005 and have spent quite a bit of time in one of the villages in the Niger Delta and have sort of seen and witnessed firsthand what the claims and cries are of people who are living there. And so we're here to personally thank the 14 Congress members of Congress who signed a letter on our behalf, and to see what we can do to sort of further, during our process of filmmaking and journalism, we certainly became sort of turned to political advocacy too, and tried to push for third-party intervention and what can be done by the international community to help resolve the situation. So we're looking forward to a week in D.C., and this has been a really inspiring sort of morning of hearing about what's happening, sort of positive end. So appreciate being here.
My name is Mariella Kevlasek. I was the project director for a group called Global Citizen Journey that brought 20 Americans to the Niger Delta in 2005 and built a library in a village outside of Wari, and also a producer on Sweet Crude. One of the things we're committed to is keeping this part of the world from being secret, and the Nigerian government would love for no one to go there, and so we are regularly pushing the envelope to bring Americans, to bring internationals into the area so they can see for themselves. And one of the goals of Sweet Crude is to tell the deeper story in a way that is accessible to the entire world, because as much as the donor community wants to do well and all, until there's political capital and people on the ground really care all over the world, it will be hard to make really amazing things happen. And the other point I'd like to make is that I agree with Dr. Suni around the issue of how entrenched the militants may be getting used to a different lifestyle. And I have observed corruption on so many levels, it becomes difficult to imagine, even if the doors are open to goodness, who steps into that on the ground? How have people not been corrupted to be unable to step into being right and integrous? And I am really committed into the idea of what could women do, a very untapped resource throughout the Niger Delta, both culturally, educationally, even politically. When you train women to run for political office, they don't have access to the kingmakers who would underwrite those campaigns. And so I think a really big deal would be if there was money accessible to qualified women who are passionate about making change. We've seen around the world, when women get into leadership roles, things change rapidly. And I think that that's a really important thing that the donor community could look at.
My name is Okechukwu Magoma. I am a fellow at the National Endowment for Democracy. I feel very pessimistic when I consider the Nigerian situation, and the reason is because we have, a bunch of political, leadership that is not committed to any change, to any reform in Nigeria, and this is because this political class is produced by a political system that enthrones, an unaccountable, you take a look at the various elections that that Nigeria, has had since 19, since the transition to semblance of democratic rule. A number of reforms that they have pretended to have, put in place have been characterized by insincerity, because you find a situation where they set up, panels to, reform certain sectors of the Nigerian system, and these panels come up with their reports. They keep these reports and set up another panel to review the recommendations of the previous panel. So I think that it is not really, it's not going to help, in my opinion, if we continue to depend on this same, class of leaders. I think what we need to do is to change the political structure, to restructure the political system that will give rise to a credible electoral process. And I don't know what has happened to the case of one of the militants who is facing trial, and the government wants to try him in camera. Now this is the same government that says the rule of law is one of the major plans of its So I think we should focus more on political research. Thank you very much.
My name is Andrew Isaye. I hail from Bayelsa State, Nigeria. My wife is from Delta State, Nigeria. We are all Ijaws. I have a daughter and a son. My daughter is Lucy. She was born back in Nigeria. My son, Guy, was born here, so he's an American Ijaw. I came into this country in 2006 by choice. I'm a permanent resident of this country. I live, work, and school here. I'm the pro tem chairman of Ijo Youth Council North American Zone. And I apologize, not on behalf of the government or on behalf of the Niger Delta youth, for those journalists that were detained. You now see what we see. And you understand what we understand. It's a shame. For those of us who have children in school, your child comes back from school to score 13% in an exam. That is a failure. 13% derivation amounts to 87% deprivation. My president has said it all. But we are looking at a different line of approach. I was trained by the USIP in 2006 on conflict resolution in Yanagua in conjunction with our Niger Delta NGO. And we are bringing a different approach into fighting for our God-given rights. One of the speakers here impressed me a great deal when he said that more emphasis should be placed on the NGOs because the political class is so highly corrupted we don't even have adjectives to qualify the level of corruption that abounds. The governor is elected, sworn into power today. Tomorrow the court says, no, you were not elected, there was no election. It goes from one state to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. So how do we classify even the presidential elections, which we say was free and fair? If it was, well, I just want to thank my president for being himself and to thank everybody that has made it possible for him to come and present our position, because the position is a pain that has been on my mind for all my 39 years of existence on earth. Okay. I want to thank the organizers of this forum, and more grease to your elbows. Keep the NGOs on site every day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Fran Farmer, and I used to live and work in Nigeria. I want to first say special greetings to Judy. We are so glad to see you out and about, and you deserve great kudos for strength. I think the previous speaker who spoke so eloquently about the role of women should be also talking about you and including you in that great group. I just wanted to mention something very briefly. When Peter talked about how vestigial the investment in the National Assembly is, he's not joking, because that's what I spent my time in Nigeria doing. And one of the things that intrigued me about all of the remarks was that when people talk about the government, they talk about the executive, when in point of fact, we have checks and balances. They have a system that's based on the same system as ours. And it seems to me that it's worth investing in the legislature. It's worth investing in the legislature. And we need to talk more about that in terms of self-determination within the country. In addition, when one is concerned about women, one of the things that was a pleasant surprise was that the women who can navigate the incredibly complicated electoral process in Nigeria. We said we thought 2003 was bad, 2007 was worse. But the women who survived that process are real nation builders and real community builders, and I think that they need to have more exposure and more investment. Last but not least, I certainly agree with Darren about electoral reform. There can be no development, there can be no peace without electoral reform. And that goes to all the different branches of government, from the local, to the state, to the national. So I would really encourage great thinkers like those on the panel and those in this room to focus on legislative development as a part of and parcel of the strategy.
Thank you. Anybody want to have a last word? Or?
Well, I'll say one thing or two things very quickly. I think that when we talk about political restructuring, as Okechukwu talked about, we keep coming back to this question of democracy, and it's worth underscoring, you know, finally, that since 1999, there has not been a credible election in any of the core states of the Niger Delta. There simply is no democracy. There are a set of governors and local government representatives who have been installed by party leaders, and rule through coercion and fraud. And that would be a credible election, a major step in the direction of changing the environment and restructuring the context in a very basic way. I think I'll leave it there because we're already over.
Okay, Darren, the last word.
Quickly on the composition of the task force, I mean, I think we can think of the major ministries that should be engaged in that. I think the most important element is that it should be chaired by the president at least maybe once a month, or if that's too much, every couple months. But a key chairmanship from the presidency is going to be important to sort of send the message on down to the ministries as to the seriousness of it. About USAID funding, you know, note that after the bad elections last year, election funding was cut. Which is, you know, it's cutting the medicine after, you know, after the patient has just had a bad day. I don't understand why that happened. And then lastly is to say, I think there's also a window of opportunity on election reform. We're going to get, the election reform committee is going to give its report by this fall. Plus, if you mix that with perhaps the Ardu administration having had a positive Supreme Court decision, there will be again another window there. But that also is going to end by early 2010 as electioneering starts to gear up. So,
Judy?
Good. In my 10 days at SAIS, I've attended four different seminars where there was a discussion about the role of women in peace building. And it's very interesting that in none of these has the role of Nigerian women come out. Because if you look at other countries like Rwanda, where there's almost 50% of women are legislators, or active roles as ministers, etc., it's very sad. And I think it's something we need to think about, how Nigerian women can be involved in the process. The comment about the insincerity, repeated panels. I mean, this has happened everywhere in Nigeria. As I said before, we worked into Fawa Balewa. The white paper was never implemented. Zanko Kataf took years for the government to actually address some of the fundamental issues that brought about some lasting peace in southern Kaduna State. I would urge you to look at the communique out of this Yanagoa meeting. I think what happened was that it never was implemented because it came from a state-level initiative. It wasn't from the federal. But the ideas there are very good, and a number of the things that we've been talking about are actually here. So why do we keep starting afresh, reinventing the wheel, when so much has been done already? Once again, I emphasize political will. It's so important, and it's all too often missing.
This discussion and the presentations will be available in a few days from now on the USIP website, www.usip.org, and audio, so that people who have not attended can listen to the presentations and discussions there. I want to thank you all for coming, and I particularly want to thank our panelists for really outstanding presentations.